on every single step and every time I was promoted or I got up to the next level was because of the people around me, was because of the team that I had around me, the mentors that I had around me, them being so open to me asking questions, to having open conversations, to being transparent about what's next.
This is the Sparkcast, a bi-weekly show where we explore the creativity, technology, and business of CG. I'm your host, Marina Antunes.
Growing up in the sprawling serenity of Portage-la-Prairie, Manitoba, Amy Tank's childhood is brimming with rural charm and the purest of pleasures. But Amy's dreams and aspirations for the performing arts were bigger than her small-town roots. Her story is one of transformation, from farm life to city dwelling, and how the stark contrast of Winnipeg's urban sprawl shaped her cultural identity and nurtured her dreams of one day gracing the stage as a Disney princess. In our conversation, Amy shares the unpredictability of her career, from the world of voice acting and a career in the healthcare sector, which started as a part-time job that evolved into a passion for supporting individuals with intellectual disabilities. The entirety of her experience has led her to her current position as a supervising producer, supporting and leading artists to do their best work. Here's our conversation with Amy Tang.
So I wanted to start by asking you about where you grew up. Did you grow up in Winnipeg?
Actually, I grew up in a small town outside of Winnipeg called Portage-la-Prairie. That's where my mom raised me and my brother. And my cousins are out there and my grandparents are out there and my aunts and uncles, and most of them still actually live out there. My mom was a single mom, so we spent a lot of time out in a place called Southport, which is outside of Portage-la-Prairie. It's a farming community, and my parents had this hobby farm, and we grew up on that farm, actually. So much of my childhood was being out on the farm and learning how to farm. And my grandpa took us out with the cattle, and me and my cousins would go get lost in the huge gardens and lose our boots in the mud and come back, and my grandma would be so angry. And so that's how I grew up. And when I was 9, my mom met my stepdad, and we moved to Winnipeg, Manitoba. So I spent my younger years, my development years, I like to call them, in the country or in, you know, rural Manitoba, and then moved to the big city when I was 9 years old.
Was that a shock after being like literally on the farm?
Oh, yeah. I was not happy to move to the city. It was not something that I wanted to do. I was really upset with my mom for uprooting us and taking us out there. And I would go back. So my mom continued to work actually in Portage-la-Prairie, and it's about an hour and a half commute. So she would commute that, oh, you know, every day, 6 days a week, 5 days a week. And so on the weekends and spring breaks and summer vacations, I would actually go like just hitch the ride with her and go back out to Portage and my grandparents and spend, that's, you know, almost every spring break and summer vacation I'd spent back in rural Manitoba, because I just loved being out there. I loved being with my family. And yeah, the shock of the city was definitely big for a 9 year old, and learning like what is the city life and all the trendy things.
You moved to the city, you're now a city girl. What does city girl Amy like to do?
Even when I was, you know, younger, in rural Manitoba, we did a lot of singing and music. So my family is very musical. My grandpa would play guitar, and all of my aunts, including my mom, sang in a choir that my grandpa actually used to run, and they would travel around North America and sing. And I believe it was a gospel choir, like with the church. But yeah, they had this big van, and like they would travel around North America when they were, you know, teenagers and stuff. So I grew up with a very musical family. We were always singing. They were always teaching us lots of different songs. And that was something that carried forward through my whole entire life. I always loved singing. I always loved putting on plays and being dramatic. And that stuck with me moving into the city. I loved still music and theater and acting, and I loved being outside. I loved riding bikes, and I wasn't ever really sporty, even though my mom put me in sports. I did skating lessons for a really long time. I played soccer, but I was never good at it, so I never stuck with it. I was the one who like wanted to sing, and I wanted to act, and that's what I kept me interested and doing things. And I was very like artsy, like drawing and painting and that sort of stuff.
So did you think that, career in entertainment was ever going to be a possibility?
That was my dream. My dream as a little girl, as far as I can remember, was to be a Disney princess, was to be the voice of a Disney princess, to sing the Disney songs. Like Little Mermaid was my movie. And I remember watching the out, I guess they do like a behind the scenes type video, and I had it on VHS, and she talks about the actress talks about becoming Ariel and singing, and I was like, that's what I want to do, like that's what I want to be when I'm older. And I think in the school yearbooks, they'd always ask you, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I would always be like famous or like actress or singer. Like that's what I wanted to do.
And you actually took some classes, didn't you?
So after I had gone the traditional route of university, started my what do I wanted what do I actually can I actually achieve living in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and I ended up after my first year of university going to my friend actually, he went into this acting school for film and television course, and I was hearing all about it and how they're doing improv and they were writing their own little scripts, and I was like, wow, that's so cool, like I want to do that. So he gave me the contact, and I ended up going into this. It was called the Academy of Broadcasting, and so there was a broadcasting school, and they made a branch off for film and television, and so it was local actresses and actors that kind of put this school together and helped us build our chops to if we wanted to break into the industry. They taught us everything from production to voiceover work to becoming an actor, to taxes and like how you become your own entity as an actor. It was a really thorough program. It was a 9-month program to and then at the very end, you kind of did a showcase of your talent of, you made a movie together, and we did like an ending showcase kind of thing. And they would always put on productions through the years where like old grads could come and new people could come and audition and be part of the musical theater scene, which is very big in Winnipeg, musical theater and Fringe Festival and all those kind of indie arts are extremely, extremely popular.
Did you take a break from traditional university to go and do this course?
I did, yeah. And because I wasn't quite sure, like part of me was like, oh, I want to be a teacher. Oh, I want to be a psychologist. Oh, I want to be a psychiatrist. Those were kind of the fields that interest me, but nothing was really like, I wasn't like super academic in terms of like, I would get like B's and maybe the occasional A minus, C's, but I wasn't like super excelling. Math was my worst subject. And so when I was in university, I didn't really like enjoy being in class, like taking notes, listening to lectures, studying, doing the exams, like it just was not, it did not inspire me in any form. So it's why I was like, you know what, let me try going down this avenue and seeing what it could potentially hold.
And so what happened after that 9 months?
Some of our teachers, and they pulled people from all over the industry within Winnipeg. Some of our teachers were actually like close with casting directors. So we would Our resumes would get sent over to casting directors, and we could make demos and send them over. And we got a chances to go audition for actual shows that were happening. and meet people, producers and directors that were in Winnipeg creating. And voiceover was something that always called to me, you know, even from a little girl, is I wanted to be that voiceover. And so I got a chance to audition with a studio called DeCapo. Their recording studio there in Winnipeg, and I actually got cast on in a part. It didn't go too far, but we did some preliminary recordings for it, and I remember, like, we had to remote in, and there was, you know, directors in LA, and I could hear them in my headphones, and I was like, oh my god, I'm living my dream. And it actually turned out to be way harder than you ever imagined. It's not just, you know, speaking, it's that inflection and how clear you are. And you start to become very self-conscious about how you say certain words. And that, you know, they would always comment how I had this on my INGs, my ing sounds, I always had this throaty kind of nasally sound that they didn't like. So it was something I had to practice, which made me self-conscious on how I spoke, but also taught me how to articulate really well, even though there's lots of times I mumble nowadays and everyone's like, what are you saying? I'm like, I don't know. I'm not being clear enough. But yeah, I did get another gig with them. So the first one was called MetaJets. And it was these teenagers and they were in space and they were having these space crafts that they would race against each other. So that was the first one. And then from that, I auditioned for something called Kung Fu Dino Posse. And that was the other cartoon. And I actually got a recurring role on it. It kind of, the Kung Fu Dino Posse is kind of like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles style show, where I think you can find it still on YouTube. I've looked, I mean, this was, well, I don't know, 25 years ago already, maybe 20, so over 20 years ago. So it was a long time ago. And I got cast as kind of the April of, like, so in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you have April, who's like the human who like helps the turtles, you know, on their missions. So I was kind of the April who helped the dinos on their missions and got to go into the recording booth quite a lot for that gig. And it was so much fun to do, and I have some fond memories in the recording studio doing that.
That's amazing. When did your career sort of take a change into healthcare?
When I was going to school, film school, I was like, okay, well, you always, even in university, I had to, you know, have a part-time job. I paid my way through school. So I fell into this part-time job in the evenings and on the weekends in a residential home supporting people with intellectual disabilities. And so I worked there on the weekends and the evenings after school. And when school ended, I didn't have anything secure. I was doing a bit of this voiceover work, but you know, it's auditioning, and they tell you when you start film school, you know, if you still do need to, most actresses and actors out there have two or three other jobs because you don't know when your next gig's going to be. And yes, it can be lucrative, but you need to pay the rent up until then. So I, you know, took this job. It was working for a nonprofit organization called Arcane Horizon. Started working for them and actually fell in love with helping people and helping people through their daily lives. And, you know, I could incorporate some of the fun that I learned in acting school to like help, you know, build relationships and to help during the day not be so bored. And, you know, we would even play some of the games that, you know, we would play in acting school when it, you know, came to like voices, you know, doing fun voices or doing really physical body movements, that sort of stuff. And I really liked it. And so when school ended, when the film and television course ended, I decided to work there full time, then was like, oh, I could be an assistant here. Assistant coordinator is what they're called. And they promoted me, and then they promoted me to the coordinator, which is like the person who runs the house. And then I slowly just loved what I was doing and made really good connections. And and they offered an opportunity to go to Red River Community College, which is a college in Winnipeg, to take a disabilities and community services certificate. It was a 2-year course, and they were offering to pay for it. And I thought, oh, well, I should take advantage of this. And then that's what I did. I went to school and I still worked for them. And after I finished that certificate, they promoted me again up into a director of support services, is what it was called. So then I was responsible for multiple homes with multiple people with challenges, and really loved doing that and loved helping people and supporting people. And I think by like nature, I'm an empathetic person, and I always want to help where I can. And so it kind of fit into my, actually my family I come from caregivers. My mom is a nurse, my grandma was a nurse. Yeah, so my aunt was a health care aide. So I think it's like that also runs a little bit in my blood of, caring for people and making sure people are healthy and safe.
Did you see yourself as doing something like that job long term? Was that something that looked like a possibility for you?
I did. Yeah, I had been there almost 8 or 9 years, and was like, okay, well, I could just keep doing this and, have my life set. And especially in out in East, it's very, where I come from, and all of my friends are married. Well, majority of them are married, have children, bought a house, have careers, and are fully, domesticated, as I like to call it. And so I could have easily, yeah, just stayed in that job and continued to do that. I had a house and I had a partner, and I was, domesticated, settled down. But there was always something, all through that time, I had stopped auditioning. I had stopped, practicing and going to that, because I just thought, like, it's a tough industry to break into. And I really needed, entertainment industry is tough. When you are the entertainment, when you're the actor, you have to really sell yourself. You really have to push all the time. And there's a lot of maybe inauthenticity that goes along with that, which I just didn't feel I could maintain. I didn't feel like it was me. So I kind of just let it go to the wayside, and thought, oh, okay, well, that industry just isn't for me. I'm just not cut out for it. And so this opportunity is here. I like it. I'm doing well in it. It's giving me all of the security in life, in terms of, enabling me to buy a house and, feel settled and secure. But underlying, there was always a itch for the creative outlet and to help, be creative in my day to day, and see that creative. I just didn't feel fulfilled. I didn't feel fully satisfied. Yeah, I had to look for something that could satisfy me. And I thought about, oh, should I audition again? Should I start auditioning again? And I never got myself to that point to get back into auditioning.
So is that what brought you to Vancouver?
Sort of, yeah. Vancouver was I was actually it, I actually had a breakdown in my relationship with my partner, and I had a really good friend that was living out here, and I had come and visit her a few times over the years. She moved here for the Olympics, the 2010 Olympics. So she moved from Winnipeg, Manitoba to Vancouver for the 2010 Olympics, because they were hiring like crazy out in Vancouver. I had come and visit her a few times out here and loved it. Just thought, oh my gosh, it's so gorgeous in Vancouver. Like, you live in such an amazing place. And she would always say, well, you can live here too. Like, why don't you just like move here? We'll get a place together. And she maintained that narrative every time we visited, and when my relationship broke down, she again was like, why don't you just come out here, come stay with me, and see how it is. And she was looking for a roommate at the time. And so I thought, Okay, I'm not in the greatest spot, like personally. You know, my relationship of 5 years has just kind of dissolved itself. I'm in this limbo, lost feeling state of I don't know where to go with my life. I was on my way to turning 30, and so I felt like I need to make a change, and maybe this is the change I need to make. So, it was tough to tell all my friends. I remember telling one of my best friends, and she has the exact same birthday as me, and she immediately started crying and was like, "What am I gonna do without you?" And I remember being so scared to tell my mom because my brother had moved away years previous to Germany. And so my brother lives in Germany, and I was about to tell my mom that I was leaving. And so she would have no children close to her. And so I remember being so scared to tell her, but and I think I waited till like maybe 2 weeks before I left. Like just not wanting to, break it to her. And so I did, and she was, of course, very understanding, very, you got to do what you want to do, and I can't stop you. So, what's your plans? And I told her where I was going to be staying and what I was going to be doing. And at first I was, I took a 6 week sabbatical from work. So I didn't actually quit. I said, you know what, I need to, I'm not doing well mentally, like health, my mental health is not good. I need to go. I need to take time off work. They were 100% understanding. So I took 6 weeks and I came out to Vancouver, and I fell in love. I absolutely loved it. I started waitressing actually right when I got here. Well, I've lies. I took time off. I took the 6 weeks and I decompressed and I just lived a little, and explored the city and the province a little bit. And then I started waitressing, because you gotta make money somehow. So, but at that point, I knew I wasn't returning. I knew, like, okay, this is where I want to be. And so I had to break the news to work and say, thank you for a great 9 years, but I'm not coming back. I still love you guys, but I need to do what's best for me. And I didn't know where that would go. I didn't know where it would lead to. I just knew that it felt good being in Vancouver. And so I decided to stay and see what could happen.
And so, when you've made that decision that you're going to stay and you have all of this experience working in healthcare, is that where you start looking for work? Like, was that even an option, or did you want to just start something completely new at
I
that point?
wanted to start something new. I always knew if I absolutely needed, I could fall back and go into, that again, but I didn't want to. Like, I felt like that was part of my mental health needing a break, was like I needed to now just take care of myself and the things that I wanted to do and needed, and fulfill the things that really inspire joy in me and make me happy. And so I was not at all looking for anything in the healthcare round range. I was looking at traveling jobs, like flight attendant, or we have something out here called the Rocky Mountaineer, which is like the train that goes through the Rockies. So I was like, oh, I could do that. Like that would be really fun. Just something completely different and new. And that's something that I absolutely love, is I love to see new things, try new things, experience new things, learn, but like not learn in a traditional like school setting, but learn through experiences.
So how did you fall into animation?
It was luck. It was pure luck. I say, I saw, I think it was on Indeed or some job hunting, that they were hiring a facility production assistant, is what they call them, FPAs, PA, production assistant. And a lot of the studios out here do that. Visual effects studios, animation studios, they hire production assistants, or a facility production assistant was specifically this job. And so I had applied at a few of them actually, and I hadn't heard anything, but finally, Rainmaker at the time called me back and they said, you know, we'd love to bring you in for an interview. I do remember when they first had the phone interview telling me that the salary, I think, was like something like $24,000 a year salary. And I was like almost barfed. Like, how could I live on 24? Like, I'm going to still have multiple jobs because, I mean, but I was like, well, let's just see what this is all about, you know? And Rainmaker has a program, and I think a few studios have this. I think Sony has this as well, that if you come in as a PA, you can work your way up through production. Or you can, you know, Rainmaker specifically, they would ask you what you were interested in. So a lot of people right out of school or that were going to Vancouver Film School or Capilano Film School, they would come after graduation and PA and say, I want to be a modeler. I want to be an animator. And they would say, okay, well, we don't have any of those positions available right now. But if you come in as an FPA, you can have a mentorship under a senior that is already working. And then perhaps if they like you, they will then hire you if a junior position opens. And so that's how I got in was, I came in for as an FPA. The facilities manager, I think, hired me maybe because I was from Winnipeg and she was from Winnipeg. So she totally saw that country, you know, hardworking country girl in me and was like, you know what, let's give this girl a chance. And I was in that FPA position for 2 weeks and got interviewed by the producers of multiple shows, and one of the shows decided to hire me just based on my hire me as a production coordinator based on my my people management experience. And so I think that's the experience that got me really into the job in the first place was managing humans. And you know, we always make jokes about managing artists and it's like wrangling cats, you know, herding the cats. And so I've been told a few times that, you know, I have a really great way of speaking to artists and understanding and this empathy and you know, treating everyone like a human. And I owe it, honestly, to that mental health training and that disabilities and community services training that I learned at Red River on just how to treat people like people.
The other thing that sort of comes to mind, I think, is the fact that, you know, you mentioned that a lot of those starting jobs, you know, you get half students coming, people coming right out of school with not a lot of people experience. You've already had an entire other career and an entire other life before you've even started this new chapter in your life.
I think the easy part about production, especially like being in production, is the easy part is learning the software. You know, learning the production software, learning the lingo, learning like, oh, this is a shot versus a scene versus a take versus an asset versus, you know, it's like, that's the easy part. You know, you can study that, you can learn that really fast. But understanding how to de-escalate someone who's agitated because the color is not right, or, getting people to hurry because you're running out of time and you still have this much stuff to go through without making them feel like you're hurrying them. Like, those are the soft skills that you can't teach people, that you just naturally have it or you don't. And I find that a lot of coordinators, production folk, the best ones are really the ones that understand humans and how to work with humans.
Well, clearly you found your groove like pretty early on. I mean, 2 weeks in that entry-level job and you were already sort of hired on to something a little bit higher up. Can you talk a little bit about that experience of sort of moving through the ranks at Rainmaker? Because you were there for quite a long time.
Yeah. I feel really lucky. I feel really blessed that that's how it all happened. I do have to owe it a lot to the supervisors I had, the directors I had, even the producers and production managers that worked above me, because they were always so open to sharing knowledge and to helping me learn and to helping me through it if there was things I didn't understand or complicated situations. And so I honestly, this these shows are a teamwork. You know, every single show that you create is a huge team all doing their part to make it work. And so if you don't, if not everyone on the team is grooving and is doing their part, it's a lot harder to get it done. And you may not be successful at doing it. So on every single step and every time I was promoted or I got up to the next level was because of the people around me, was because of the team that I had around me, the mentors that I had around me, them being so open to me asking questions, to having open conversations, to being transparent about what's next. For me, also knowing that when I got into that production coordinator role, it was like, this is where I meant, I literally felt this is where I'm meant to be. This is what I'm meant to be doing. Like, this is the job for me. You know, and even as I moved up the production manager, I was like, this is my jam. Like, I love being a production manager. Like, it was so fulfilling, every single part of it, even the hard days when you're working late nights and you're working 15 hours, you know, even though, shh, no, we never work that. You know, it was easy because it was something I absolutely loved with every like ounce of me. And so I knew that when I was a coordinator, I wanted to become a production manager. So it was like, how do I get there? What are the things that I need to do to get there? And I would ask those questions out of the production managers that were around me and the producers. And I would say, like, I want to be you, you know? And thankfully, Rainmaker, now Mainframe, has such a culture of inspiring people and allowing people to grow and giving them that mentorship. As you know, if they're searching for it, they will do their best to help give that to you so that you can grow and you can learn and you can see your true potential, your full potential. Like I said, I'm so blessed to have had and still have the people around me that have helped me grow into those positions. And you know, I was promoted to a supervising producer last year, and the executive vice president, it took her 2 weeks to convince me to take the job. I did not want to take it. I was like, nope, I don't want, I'm so happy being a line producer. I do not want to be a supervising producer. No, thank you. And everyone was like, oh my God, why? Like, that's the job for you. And I'm like, no. Don't want it. So yeah, 2 weeks it took her to convince me to and you know, begrudgingly I said, fine, I'll take it. I'll do it. And you know, I did it, and of course I loved, you know, I loved being that support for the line producers. Because like I said, every step in production, your role is to support. Your role is to help people. It's to help them find the information. It's to pass along the information. It's to help find the things that they can't find. Or, hey, we had this note. Where is it? You know, where is this design? Where is this content? Like, you're literally, your job is a helper and a communicator. And that's what I feel like I thrive at, is helping and communicating. So, you know, I loved being the supervising producer. I have now stepped back down into a line producer just because the situation of the industry, and you know, there's not a lot of work out there right now, and so everyone's kind of had to step down and maybe do their part in to help keep the studios alive. And I am absolutely loving being back in the producer role. Like, it is like, I am like, oh yes, this is what it feels like to not have to make those executive decisions and not, you know, it's not have to work out those budgets and those, you know, I mean, there's still a little bit of that, but it's not as much pressure, you know? And so being back on the floor, essentially, you know, being in the nitty-gritty of the shots, knowing the shot details, having the daily conversations with the supes and the artists, you know, that's what I love the most about our job, is just the teamwork it takes to create these, and the fact that we're creating cartoons for people's enjoyments, for children's enjoyments, you know, like I get joy out of, you know, even it's preschool and I get joy out of watching it. So how could we ever have a, you know, better job? Like, I always remind the team, like, we're living the dream here. We're making cartoons, y'all.
You're literally making the cartoons that you watched when you were a kid.
And that my friends' kids watch now, right? And they message me like, hey, is there a new one coming out? Hey, what's the scoop on this? I'm like, I can't tell you. I'll tell you when it's on the YouTubes and on the Netflix. I'll tell you when it airs.
You know, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about, you know, learning on the job. You touched on something that I think is really interesting in this idea that the things that are like the day-to-day, the tools that you're using, that's something that you can learn. But for some people, it might be easier to learn that than for others. On a one-to-one basis, can you kind of walk us through, you know, your process for learning something new, like for learning a new tool, let's say?
I can't sit there and watch someone do it and then go back to my desk and be like, okay, I can do it. I need to be the one to actually click the buttons and to do the things. And so when I was first becoming a production coordinator, I spent so much time clicking through ShotGrid, previously known as ShotGrun, but I spent countless hours just clicking around to know where, oh, if I click here, this is this. If I click here, this is this. And when people would, I would ask for help or like, hey, how do I do this? They would be like, oh, let me show you. And then I would always say, no, can you actually just walk me through it and let me click? And they would be like, okay, yeah. But I know, and this is my problem too, is like, I'm not very good at telling someone, oh, this is where you like, go to this, then go to this, go to this. I have to literally click on those things. And sometimes I don't even remember until I see the screen. And then I'm like, oh yeah, it's over here on the left, or over on the right, you know? So for me, it was visual learning and hands-on learning. I needed to be the one to click it. And I needed to be the one to move through the software to remember and to know where to click, how to load something in, how to play something. And I feel like we work in such a visual industry that a lot of people are like that. And so it's a lot of spending that extra time, whether it's over your lunch break or after hours, understanding the software so you can better use it the next time you have to in a review, you know, when it matters, when the time matters. So I think that, you know, I talked about the soft skills and knowing people, but there's another thing that I think a production person needs, and that's hunger. That's hunger to learn and hunger to know and hunger to understand. Because if you don't have that wanting to understand, wanting to learn, wanting to know the information, then you kind of remain stagnant. Our, as with lots of tech industries, our industry is changing all the time. The software is getting updated. There's new tools, there's new buttons, there's new ways. So we constantly have to be hungry to know that information and learn. Just because we learned how this worked a year ago doesn't mean that it's the same and it's going to work as efficiently as it did a year ago, you know? And so staying relevant and continuing to click through the software and learn it and know it, you know, and knowing how you learn. I think that's so important. Like, how do you retain information? Because some people can watch a video and they get it. You know, I'm not that person. I can watch the video and then I now need to step-by-step the video and click on it, me click on it as they're step-by-stepping the video, you know, and then maybe do it again without the video, so like it retains in my brain of like muscle memory, like, okay, yeah, click here, click here, click here, okay, yeah, there we go, got it.
For the soft skills, which I think is something that's so important, not enough of us think about, so I want to pick your brain a little bit about this, because, you know, asking for help can be really difficult, especially when you're like the new kid on the block and you don't really know anybody else, and you know, you might be maybe afraid of your supervisor or your boss. Do you have some hints on, you know, how to sort of like break in and kind of start building those relationships and asking those those questions that you might need answers to, especially in a time now where we're kind of like in this new hybrid era where you might not even be seeing people in person for like entire days at a time.
That's a tough one, especially, you hit on like if you're scared of your supervisors or scared of your directors, because I mean, let's face it, not everyone in our industry is a nice person to have to deal with, especially, stakes are high for them and stress can get the better of everyone. And so sometimes it is tough to approach someone if you think that they're not going to be nice to you and you still have to get that information. And so how do you get that information? How do you learn? How do you ask questions? And there's a level of bravery that comes with it of okay, deep breath and shoot. But what I always try to recommend to people when I know that there's maybe a challenging person that they have to work with to try to get information is I try to first understand how that person works. So, are they the type that likes to give you lots of information, or are they a type that you need to pull out all the information from? Because there's lots of different types of personalities and how people answer questions when you're asked. And so being thoughtful about what type of question you need to ask and what information you actually are requiring. I think that's where you start is like, what do I actually need to know here? Something I was taught as I was coming up in production was an executive summary. And so it's basically peeling out all the words and just saying the basic facts, like no longer than, one, two sentences max. And so that's something I think all of us struggle with is like we say too many words and we don't need to say all of those words. We just need to get right down to the meat of what we need. So I'm always, mentoring folks to, okay, pare it down. Okay, you don't need to say that. That's irrelevant information. What are you asking for? You just need to know this specific information. So ask that specific information. Or another tactic I like to use is I usually give options. So I will say, okay, this is about to happen. Here are the options. And I always put like an A and a B. So that way, that person can answer A or B. They don't have to type anything else out. They can read it. They can understand I have option A, I have option B. So it's simplifying all of our communication so that other people can then simply reply back to us and then we have the information that we need. And so that's one of my biggest advices is simplify the information. Sometimes a lot of times people ramble when they're nervous. They just talk and talk and talk. And you're always like, oh my gosh, can they just stop talking so we can get, like I can say something back. And I think that's something to be conscious of, is say what we need to say. We don't have to, there's power in silence. There is so much power in silence. And so allow for that silence, allow for that moment of breath, and then be thoughtful about what you're responding with on is it going to get you the information you need? Because you might only have 30 seconds left for that meeting to get you what you need. So let's use it smartly.
One of the things that I hear a lot from people that work in the industry is network, 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 network. You can never go wrong with networking, but it's hard. A lot of people are not people. A lot of us are introverts or, we're not super comfortable in a group of people. What are your recommendations or do you have any tips for folks on sort of, how to network? How do you get out there and meet other people?
Oh yeah, that's tough. Like you hit it. Majority of our industry are introverts. I would say at least 90% of the industry is an introvert in terms of VFX and, you know, animation and even the live action side of things. You know, people are the lighting and the grips and the, you know, those people. So they don't have to talk to people. So they don't have to be in front of the camera, you know? So they're like, no, I don't want to talk to people. And I don't want to go have a conversation with them. I am a people person. I've always been a people person. I love talking to people. I love meeting new people, you know, having conversations, learning things. For those who don't like it, I know how hard it is. I have a lot of friends that are introverted and they just are like, no, I don't want to do it. I can't do it. And that's okay. I think that it's, I don't know that you necessarily have to network as much if you want to maintain being an artist and you are good at what you do, you know, you're positive, you do your work on time, you know, your work speaks for itself. I don't think you necessarily have to do all that networking because you're real, your demo reel and your work and your name will carry, that will all carry through. It's if you want to start getting into those supervisor positions, those management positions, those director positions, you've got to sort of fake it until you make it. You know, there's a lot of people that still are in those positions that do hate networking and being in public and public speaking. But when they have to, they do it. They put on that face, that mask. And it's almost like sort of separating yourself from the reality of what it is, you know, almost like you're putting on a costume to then go do a performance. And while I hate that because I, you know, I think that we don't have enough authentic humans in the world. And I think it's very important. And it's something I cherish and appreciate is authentic interactions and relationships. I think that for those who have trouble putting themselves out there, that's a tool that they can use to cope with the anxiety that they might feel in having to be in front of a large amount of people or to network with people. I think that also, yeah, so that fake it till you make it is huge. And I also think that, you know, something I said before is that you just have to take a deep breath and shoot. Know that the person that you're trying to approach and talk to is just a human and is probably just as awkward as you are. So... You know, we're all humans. We all have, no one is perfect. No one in this whole entire world is perfect. And you are not embarrassing yourself any more than that person might feel embarrassed either. You know, talking to you or blubbing a word or a phrase or, you know, saying something, that they're like, oh, too much information, you know? I think our egos get in the way too much and we think too hard about, oh no, I said this or I looked this way or, you know, but really no one's remembering that because they're thinking about themselves and, oh no, I did this and I did, you know, that happened. So it's actually never what you think it is. It's never what it seems.
Over the course of your career so far, you've clearly had, you know, you mentioned that you had a lot of people supporting you and giving you, you know, open door to ask questions and to learn. One piece of advice that somebody gave you that you would pass on, if you could only give one piece of advice, what would that be?
Something that sticks with me that I often say to the team is that something that one of my producers said to me when I was coming up, and I used to get really hard on myself about making mistakes. When I would make a mistake and I would get really upset and, you know, whether it was like wrong information in email or, you know, accidentally putting in something that wasn't accurate. And he would say to me, oh my gosh, you're a human. You made a mistake. I can't believe that you're a human. And I think honestly that carries through absolutely everything that we do, not only professionally, but personally, is just that you're a human. You're allowed to make mistakes. As long as you are open and transparent about, hey, you know what? I made that mistake. Apologies. and you're open and willing to correct it and give that information, then that's how everyone should live their lives. You know, we're bound to make mistakes. We have to be. No one is perfect. No one's ever going to be perfect. And this world wouldn't be so beautiful if we all were perfect. So own those mistakes, and allow yourself to be human, and then just keep forging ahead to be better.
And that was our conversation with Amy Tang. You can find out more about Mainframe Studios and Amy's work there at their website at mainframe.ca.
The Sparkcast is a production of the Spark Computer Graphics Society. Opening and closing credits by Michael Edlin. Editing and additional production support by Joshua Peterman. For more about SparkCG and our upcoming events, visit sparkcg.org.